you won't, and I will attempt to not use hydrodynamic language as well. So this is some work that I've done with, that I've been doing with Tassos Petkou and Marios Petropoulos and a team of other people in Paris over the last little while. And I've actually gotten away from this in the last few months, and so this is sort of a nice opportunity to motivate me to try to get back into it, because the point of the talk is that I'm going to try to show you that there are some interesting, potentially interesting problems or interpretations that we might be able to build in certain holographic models. So let me. Well, that's what I was. That was my original plan. So I was going to tell you a whole bunch of stuff about fermions and Mott gaps, dynamically induced gaps in systems, and then aging and disorder and things like that. But as I said, I've narrowed things down, and I'm going to talk. I'm just going to talk about rotating fluids. Okay. So just to begin with some motivation, there are a lot of current experiments that, to be honest, I don't know much about, but on rotating Bose gases, you know, these things like in harmonic traps, people also play with rotating superfluid systems. And one of the interesting features of these systems is that the rotation can mimic the more familiar effects of a magnetic field. And there's lots of predictions that people are making. There are lots of experiments, as I said. And one of the interesting things is that whereas if the rotation is very small, you might say be in some Bose condensate, it's argued that as you spin up the system, you can get into interesting strongly coupled phases, which are, for example, are the analog of quantum Hall phases that you see in strong magnetic fields for charge systems. So our original motivation was then to look at holographic systems that have rotating boundary fluids, and just to try to understand them and see if we could make any contact with this physics. Okay, so just to put a little bit more meat on that, if you just look at the single particle dynamics in a rotating frame. So again, I'm thinking of a system of some atoms in a harmonic trap. If you suppress the motion in the, say, the third direction, what you find is a Hamiltonian, again, a single particle Hamiltonian of this form, where it looks like you have a gauge potential, which is set by the angular momentum, and you also find harmonic terms that you could imagine, for example, tuning away. If you tuned the rotation to the natural frequency, you could get rid of that harmonic term. And then this would just literally look like the Hamiltonian of a charge in a magnetic field, where the magnetic field is the role of the magnetic field, as I said, is played by this rotation. Okay, so with that sort of setup, then you expect that the states of the system organize into Landau levels, and you could possibly get quantum Hall states. Okay, so the physics is fairly simple.
Except these are bosons, right?
In this case, yeah, I was just talking about bosons. Okay, so what I'm going to do here, as I said, I'm not going to think in hydrodynamic language. Instead, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take some explicit examples of holographic systems and just work out some of their properties. Okay, so in particular, we're going to find some geometries, and I'll give you a pretty general description of what these geometries, or a general class of such geometries. And the fluids will have vorticity. So that's the quantity that you need that would mimic the magnetic field. Okay, and what we'll find is that you should think of these explicit backgrounds as providing, apparently, a boundary fluid, which is in local equilibrium, but nevertheless having non-trivial properties such as vorticity. Okay, and one of the things that I got interested in here is that generically these geometries have classical problems. So I'll show you an example where you have closed time-like curves, for example. And you might then ask, well, does this holographic picture of this rotating fluid give you some new way to think about that classical problem? Even though there are closed time-like curves, perhaps there's a new interpretation for what that might mean from the fluid's point of view. Okay, and I'll suggest, although we really need to do some numerical work, and we'll get to this later in the talk, I'll suggest that you can think of those effects as sort of an analog gravity setup for the acoustics or the optics in rotating media. Okay, and if there's any time at all left at the end, I'll talk a little bit about Hall viscosity. All of the examples that I'm going to talk about here have four-dimensional bulks, and so they're 2+1 boundary systems. Okay, and just to be different, I'm going to describe the holography of these systems in the first order formalism, and that's just I think you'll see as we go along that it's convenient in a certain sense in organizing what's going on. But in those terms, so by first order formalism, I just mean that I'm going to talk about a coframe rather than a metric explicitly. And in that formalism, then, the energy momentum tensor is cast as a vector valued one form. Okay, and I'll call that a stress current. Okay, it's the diffeomorphism current. Okay, and then, so as I said, we'll work out several explicit examples, and we'll see that the boundary systems have a stress tensor that, if you compare it to what Pavel told us about hydrodynamics, we'll see that it's that the stress tensor has a perfect fluid form, but the velocity field in these backgrounds have vorticity. Okay, and the two examples I'm going to consider are ADS Kerr and ADS Taub-Nut. Okay, so let's get started. So we're just going to do standard Pfefferman-Gram, okay? And in this first order formalism, I just choose to write the Pfefferman-Gram form of the metric in this way, where I'm identifying an explicit coframe, which in the bulk I call capital E. And we'll do the usual radial slicing of the coframe. Okay, we'll expand it in particular near the boundary as follows. And you would do the same thing for the spin connection. Okay, and at least in the absence of torsion, I'll talk about torsion later in the talk, but in the absence of torsion, of course, the spin connection and the coframe are related to one another, and everything is determined by, as usual, the two quantities in the expansion. And the leading non-normalizable guy is, in fact, you can interpret as the coframe of the boundary theory, and the normalizable guy is in fact the expectation value of the stress current, okay, or the energy momentum tensor.
Okay.
Good. So again, I'm in this first order formalism. This is really the metric. This is really the stress tensor. But everything's written as a one form, as a set of one forms. Okay, so good. So the stress current, again, just think of it as as what you would get by varying the action with respect to the frame rather than the metric. And the connection is simply between the stress current and the stress tensor is that you just need to plug in the coframe and pull out, and the coefficients. The coefficients are the components of the stress tensor. Okay, so in all of the backgrounds that I'm going to consider, the boundary metric turns out to be of this form. It's stationary, okay, it's time independent. But in general, there's a non-trivial, there's a non-trivial spatial one form here. and there's, in general, a non-trivial metric. Okay, and it's natural to identify then, you don't have to, but it's natural, given the form of the metric, to identify a coframe for the boundary in this form. Okay, so the time-like guy has this one form B in it. And for historical reasons, well, I'll refer to this as the Randers frame or the Randers coframe, and the one form, the spatial one form, B is the Randers one form. Okay, so the corresponding frame just looks like this. Okay, and the special feature that this frame has is that it's stationary, time independent, but it's co-moving. And in fact, if you look at the other term in the Pfefferman-Graham expansion, I'll show you that in the next transparency, but what you find is that stress current is just takes a perfect fluid form, okay, in which the fluid velocity, the velocity in the stress tensor is just E0. Okay? So that fact identifies this Randers frame as the co-moving frame of the fluid. Okay, so yes, good. So as I was saying, and in addition, of course, the system is conformal, so the stress tensor is traceless, and what you find when you do the Pfefferman-Graham expansion is that the stress current looks like that, looks like this, or equivalently, maybe in a more familiar form, you can write the stress tensor in the, as I said, in the perfect fluid form, where E and P are related. Okay, so that, it might be a bit of a surprise that given that general form, that you always get those results, but that's true. So just to orient ourselves, what's going on there, let's just look at the derivative expansion of the velocity field. Okay, this is much like Pavel told us in the last talk, although the notation is probably different. But just by, again, there's no hydrodynamics here. All that I'm doing is I'm decomposing the covariant derivative of U into various tensors, symmetric, traceless, antisymmetric, etc. Okay, and as Pavel noted, the viscous part of a general stress tensor can be written down in terms of shear and bulk viscosities in terms of these tensors. And in 2 plus 1, if you have parity violation, there's an additional term. The coefficient's called the Hall viscosity or dissipationless viscosity. Again, this is written in terms of U and sigma. Okay. And so given the result that the stress tensor is perfect, means that these terms all vanish in the background fluid that we've constructed. And the way that happens is that you can just check that because U is given by E0, or the one form is given by E0, the properties of U are just determined by this Randers one form B. Okay. And if you just work that out, what you find is that this fluid has zero acceleration, it has zero shear, and it has zero expansion. But in general, there's a non-zero vorticity. Okay, the vorticity is the antisymmetric part, and you can just think of that as up to a factor of 2 that we put in. Essentially, it's just the exterior derivative of the velocity. Okay, or for these backgrounds, it's the exterior derivative of the one form B. Okay, so all of these terms vanish simply because the shear and the expansion and the acceleration happen to vanish. Okay, so the interpretation then is apparently that what these backgrounds are describing are fluids that are in local equilibrium. They're not dissipating, okay, but they're fluids that have a non-trivial vorticity. Okay, so that's just what I said. And when you look at the details, the energy density and pressure are just constants. Okay, so I said that this is a non-dissipating state of the fluid. Of course, there could be dissipation if you put in fluctuations around the background, and so that's something that we would like to study. But we'll talk about it a little bit later in the talk. But we're just at the stage of setting up the problem.
Rob, can I ask a question? Sorry, maybe it's a dumb question. So on the boundary, the vorticity squared, I guess, it's a scalar and it's conserved, right? Is that a conserved quantity?
What do you mean by conserved? You mean d omega? Or
yeah, I mean like an integral of omega squared over d to x, it's a constant. There should be, right, when something, for rotating fluid, apart from energy, you have to have something else that's conserved, right? I'm just trying to figure out.
I'm just trying to figure out why you're asking, why you're constructing that particular quantity.
I'm just wondering if, does it change the number of vortex lines, or is that fixed, or?
Why don't you hold the question Okay, so as we motivated before, the vorticity you would think is the analog of the magnetic field, and in fact, if you think more about the Pfefferman-Gram expansion, the vorticity appears really in the same sort of place in the expansions as a magnetic field does. Okay, so let me just remind you that if we have a bulk gauge field, the standard picture is that we get a vector field and a charge density in the expansion, okay. And in particular, if we look at A0, then this rho zero is the density. Sorry, I said density. I meant of current, of course. Okay, but the zero component is the charge density. The zero component of A is the chemical potential. But if we looked at other components of the gauge field, if we turn on, say, AX, a magnetic field in the boundary would sit in this way in the leading term. And indeed, that's where that's how the vorticity comes about as well, if we just rewrite down the similar expression for the frame that I wrote earlier. Okay, so you sort of expect that the structure is analogous. Okay, so let's look at some specific examples. So the first example I'll look at is ADS care. Okay, here's the metric written in a standard set of coordinates in the bulk. And what you find if you do the Pfefferman-Gram expansion is a boundary metric of this form. Okay, and so if you stare at this, you can see that there's a Randers 1 form, which is in the axial direction. Okay, if the coefficient depends on theta, and so the vorticity is non-zero. Okay, and if I choose the frame that's sort of staring you, the coframe that's staring you in the face here, then this just it, you can work it out. It's just cos theta times E1. Wedge E2. And indeed, this is an example of the sort of structure that we wrote down earlier. And when you work out the stress tensor, you find that it has that perfect fluid form, it's conformal, and it has this smooth vorticity.
So when you say the dual field is perfect, it really means the stress energy tensor. Looks like.
It looks like, yeah. That's,
but it's,
yeah.
Not, it's not a perfect.
Did I right. Yeah. I said it clearly before, right? More clearly?
The coefficients don't need to vanish.
So you look at a state that has vanishing
yeah.
Sharing spectrum.
Okay. A second example is ADS Taub-Nut. There's a Lorentzian version, okay, and written here in some standard coordinates. And what this solution has is not, it no longer has a rotation parameter that we called A in the ker, but instead there's a nut charge that I've labeled as N. And this is a solution to the bulk Einstein equations, but it has some interesting properties that I'd like to flesh out a little bit, not in too much detail. Okay, one of the interesting property that we'll make use of later is that it has a large isometry group. Okay, it's homogeneous and axisymmetric. It has a horizon at a place that I'll call R plus, and there's a special point at theta equals pi. I'm writing it in coordinates that look like theta and phi look like coordinates on a sphere. They want to be coordinates on a sphere. And what you find is that at theta equals pi, there's a Misner string. And this extends all the way from the horizon out to the asymptotic region. And these things have been studied for many years, back to the 60s. Misner, in particular, showed that this is sort of an invisible string, much like a Dirac string for a monopole, if you compactify the time coordinate, and otherwise in units of the nut charge, but otherwise it's a coordinate singularity. Okay. And so this isn't a great picture, but what you should have in mind here is that we have this bulk Taub-Nut spacetime, and the boundary is roughly spherical, but there's this string singularity that runs out to a point on the boundary. Okay. Now, if you look at ker, on the other hand, ker is in some sense a pair of nut anti-nut charges. And so there is no string that has to be taken off to infinity. So it will have better properties at the boundary. Okay, so let me say a little bit more about the boundary metric for the Taub-Nut. If we do the Fefferman-Gram expansion, what you find is a metric of this form. Okay. And the Randers 1 form is written there. Now there's a subtlety. Oops, sorry. There's a subtlety here, which is that there's actually a delta function singularity lurking here because you can trace it back to the fact that the frame field is not well defined at theta equals pi. Okay, so. The vorticity has a smooth piece, which just comes from sort of the obvious derivative of that form. But there's also, a delta function piece at the south pole at theta equals pi. Okay, so this looks like what we have is rotation, but there's also a point, let's call it a vortex. Okay. And this in fact is the remnant of the Misner string that, as I described earlier, goes all the way up to the boundary.
So for ker, you would not have
ker. Yeah, ker does not. Ker is smooth at both poles. Okay. So as I said, if we insist on taking time to be Lorentzian and non-compact, which seems like a nice thing to do. What you find, in addition, is that this Misner string is surrounded by a region of closed time-like curves. Okay, these are constant T slices, and what happens is that the metric is such that as you, depending on the radius that you're at, as you increase theta, at some point, g phi phi becomes negative, and because phi is compact, you you get a closed time-like curve. These are not geodesics, though. Okay, so they're maybe not as bad as you as they could be. Okay, so as I said, the stress current takes the same form as it does for all of these Randers boundary metrics. For all of these all of the systems that that are of the type that we're discussing here. One way to characterize the vorticity is to just integrate it over the two sphere, and what you find is that that integral just reproduces the nut charge. So this is what I was having you wait for, because I think that's probably what you're asking for. Okay. So again, okay. So if you compute this for care is like a dipole, and so that integral vanishes. And in fact, for care, there are no CTCs as well. Okay. Now, let's just ask the question, in fact, for both of these geometries, if you zoom into the north or the south pole, what does the geometry and the boundary look like? Well, what you find near the north pole, for both geometries, in fact, is what's called a Somery-Chowdhury metric. Okay, just written here. Rho is essentially just theta when theta is small. Okay, and this parameter omega, well, I didn't write it, but it depends on either A or N, depending on which case we're talking about. Okay, and this metric is sort of similar to Gödel metrics, and in fact, there are CTCs at large radius. Okay, so if you go far enough away from the origin, if this was your metric, you would start to see CTCs on constant time surfaces. But note that that's, for this geometry, that only occurs for a relatively large rho. Right. And in fact, if you sew the whole thing together for care, you find, as I said, that even though it looks like you're going to develop CTCs for care, in fact, when you sew it together, you don't. Now, if you look at the south pole for either case, then you can tell the difference between care and Taubnut. What happens for care is that the metric again at the south pole just looks exactly the same form. Okay, but for Taubnut, instead, what you get is a metric that has several names. Sometimes it's called a spinning string metric or a vortex metric. Okay, and this also has closed time-like curves associated with it. Okay. So that's the, when we focus on the poles, that's the difference between care and Taubnut. And the appearance of this vortex metric is, again, a manifestation of the Misner string. Okay, so what I would like to do is to play around with the idea that this apparently sick region of closed time-like curves in the bulk geometry that extends out to the boundary might be reinterpreted as a sort of analog metric which surrounds a vortex. Okay, what I'm referring to here is that if you say in a superfluid, if you have a vortex and you consider fluctuations of some fields, maybe scalar fluctuations or fluctuations of the fluid itself, what you will find is an effective met. It looks like the fluctuations are propagating in a space-time of the form that I just showed you. Okay, if that's the right interpretation, then these closed-time-like curves are not indicating a sickness of the theory, but they just go along part and parcel with the vortex. Okay, now this is not a superfluid, right? We don't have a conserved charge. It's a neutral fluid. But nevertheless, I think there's, nevertheless, it's a useful analog to keep in mind.
I missed something, sorry.
Good.
Maybe I'm tired. Okay, so here's your thing, and the bulk, that's a top knot, and you're telling me that you go the boundary, you got your vortices on the boundary.
I have one vortex.
You have one.
I have vorticity. The fluid has vorticity over the entire.
And so you have one vortex.
But there's
there's
a vortex.
Okay, so that's close to the experiment. You know, they're getting like 10 vortices, so they're really not seeing the quantum hole. But okay, so you get one vortex, and then now what are you saying about CPCs?
Well, I'm just saying that
because that's a perfectly normal system, right? The boundary with this vortex, right? There's nothing sick about it.
Excuse me. That's right. That's the point, is that there is nothing sick about that.
Okay.
But there's a way to, what I'm referring to is that there's a way of thinking of there being sort of an effective metric in the vicinity of a vortex. So if you, it's much like if you're familiar with, you know, analog gravity discussions, what people do is they take a fluid, they consider fluctuations on it, say just a
sound,
just Klein-Gordon or sound or whatever,
yeah.
And what you find is that I'll give you a little bit more detail later, but what you find is that it just looks like a system propagating in a non-trivial metric, okay? That can have
it's one dimension up, because with analogs are always one dimension up, so it's flat, three-dimensional, and then
here I'm talking about 2 + 1.
Okay, very good. I think I'm getting.
Can I ask another question?
Sure.
So, why is the fact that in the boundary you have this interpretation with this analog metric? Why does that make the apparent sickness of these CPCs in the bulk okay? Is that a suggestion?
It's the opposite. The sickness in the bulk makes the boundary sick.
Well, okay, good. So that's certainly what I think. That's actually why I'm talking about this, right? I mean, that certainly would be the anybody's initial reaction, that there has to be something wrong with this, right? No, I'm not saying that the bulk. I didn't mean to say that that it makes the bulk sensible. What I meant to say was that from the boundary's point of view, there could be a perfectly sensible interpretation of what's going on. Now, when you push that back into the bulk, you get a bad geometry, but maybe that means you should take it seriously, because it does have if it has a sensible boundary interpretation.
But without analog gravity, everything is just fine. Okay, I mean, you just basically have atomic condensate with vortices. Let's say one vortex, just fine. But now you want to reinterpret that from the analog gravity point of view, which you don't have to, right? And then extend to the bulk. Is that what am I missing?
I don't know what you're missing. Let me go on and
okay.
I think I'm a little bit ahead of myself, which is maybe part of the problem. Okay. So one way that you can, I just want to show you that, you know, the nature of what's going on at the region where the CTCs start. Okay, so recall first that the fluid that we obtained by the Pfefferman-Gram expansion was in the co-moving frame. Okay, so one thing that you could ask is, can I boost myself if I'm an observer moving with the fluid, can I boost myself into a frame and try to construct, say, synchronous surfaces, spatial surfaces. Okay, and it turns out that, well, generically, of course, the answer is yes. Here I'm going through the details. What you end up with is a metric of this familiar form. And again, for historical reasons that I'm not going to go into, this we're referring to this as a Zermelo frame. Okay, but what you find, okay, so the thing that is distinct about Taub-Nut, which doesn't happen in CARE, is that you can't do this globally on the entire boundary. Okay, this transformation is just a local Lorentz transformation, and what you find is that the transformation diverges precisely at the point where CTC region starts. Okay, so this form WI, which appears in the Zermelo metric, in the lingo it's referred to as the wind, but it's just, you can just think of it as the components of the velocity relative to the two observers that I described. Okay. And that goes to one at the boundary of the CTC region. Okay, now for CARE, what you find is that you can do that globally, and in fact, once you go to the Zermelo frame for the CARE metric, there's a linear diffeomorphism that just gives you a static metric. Okay, so CARE has special properties that are not shared by Taubnut or many other such metrics. Okay, so this is much like a horizon. Okay, so the properties of this are much like a horizon. Now, on the other hand,
is it like a horizon, or you have something that goes to speed of light, but there's no, it's kind of in the transverse direction. It's in a different. You have something that's rotating very fast.
Yes.
But I would say it's a horizon if you cannot. So the velocity is going this way. Say, you can cross it this way. You can cross it the other way.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have a horizon.
Yeah, that's why I said like a horizon. It's just again, you can think about perhaps a better way to say it is simply that this is that the constant t slices are becoming that g phi phi is switching sign there. So in some sense, the light cones are lying down. Okay, so what I want to suggest is that perhaps we can think of this as an analog horizon in some sense, although admittedly I don't have any evidence, because I think this will take a great deal of numerical work.
Can you go a couple slides back to the Zermelo metric?
Sure.
So if hij was just delta ij, then wi's would be just the velocities. This is the usual acoustic metric.
Yeah.
Unit sound velocity or something, or whatever, lambda, I don't know, right? Or gamma, whatever you call it. So what's the difference? So this, okay.
Well, okay, yeah, sorry.
Hij is not delta ij. I mean,
It's not delta ij, but
right.
That's what I meant to say, is that in fact this is of the form, this is of the precise form of those analog metrics or the acoustic metric.
Right.
If you want to talk about optics rather than acoustics, you would have a similar expression. So that's part of the motivation for the idea. Okay, so. Anyway, so as I said, there's no numerics yet, but what I just want to describe a little bit is an attempt to set up the problem. Of course, so what we want to do is we want to study fluctuations. Okay, the idea would be that the physics of this horizon, of this quote horizon, if that's the right interpretation, should show up in some way in the study of the fluctuations. On the other hand, even for CARE ADS, this sort of question of just studying fluctuations is an interesting and hard problem, at least at finite frequency and momentum. Okay. But let me skip over that and just go to Taubnut, because I can sort of try to frame some of the problems involved. First of all, so one nice thing about Taubnut is that, as I mentioned before, it has this large isometry group. Okay, and so if I consider wave equations in the bulk, and I'll just consider here a scalar for simplicity, just because we should understand that one first. What you'll find is that the solutions organize into representations of the symmetry, and so it has a large symmetry, but it's organized in a sort of peculiar way. Here I've written the generators, and in particular the L3 generator of the SU2 is twisted between d by d phi and d by dt. Okay. And so what that means, if you think about the orbits of the SU2 in spacetime, they won't be closed curves, but they'll be generically helices. Okay, so you can write down just a massive Klein-Gordon scalar in the bulk. Okay, and what you find is that this system is easily separable. Okay, in particular, if I call omega the frequency and m the L3 eigenvalue, again because of this twisting between d by d phi and d by dt, you find that the phi dependence actually depends on omega. And, I guess I never mentioned it, but x here is just sine squared theta over 2. So it's a coordinate that goes from 0 to 1 as you go from the north to the south pole. Okay, and as I said, this can be separated, the radial motion can be separated from the theta dependence or the x dependence. Okay, and the equation that you end up with for the x dependence is just hypergeometric, and it's twisted in a certain way by this parameter, by the nut charge. Okay. And if you look for solutions if you just follow your nose and look for solutions that are normalizable on the whole range from x equals 0 to x equals to 1, you find two branches of solutions. One type of solution that you find are what are usually called monopole harmonics. Okay, and but because of this twisting, they exist in fact at discrete values of the frequency set by the nut charge. Okay, and in fact, this is all you would have if you did what Misner advocated and compactified the time coordinate. Okay, you would find that. I probably mean two. There's probably a 2 pi in there somewhere that I forgot. But okay, if you do what Misner, if you do Misner's calculation, what you find is that the time coordinate is compactified in just the right way. That all of the frequencies, all of the allowed frequencies, are discrete, and that's why these are called monopole harmonics. Because in that situation, the Misner string is invisible. It's like a Dirac string in the presence of a monopole. Okay, and these are just all of the normalizable modes. Okay, and in fact, if you go to omega equals to 0 in particular, they just become the ordinary spherical harmonics. Okay, if you don't compactify time, on the other hand, as I said, you find another branch of solutions whenever omega is bounded by 1 over 2n. And So you find another branch of solutions. It's a continuous branch, okay, but it's bounded. And because omega isn't quantized in just the right way, if you go around, if you take the solution around the vortex at theta equals pi, the scalar field comes back to itself, but up to a phase. Okay, These modes are anionic in that sense. They transform by a phase as you go around the vortex.
So n is integral?
No. It's arbitrary.
It's real?
It's real, yeah. Okay. Now what we don't have here is, okay, so if you think about what I would be doing here, what I would like to do is to put in an arbitrary scalar fluctuation at any value of the frequency and any SU2 times U1 representation. Sorry, any SU2 representation. Okay, but apparently the normal, I claim this is all of the normalizable solutions that you can find, and this doesn't cover all possible omega. Okay, you just have this continuum, and then you have a discrete set of frequencies. So it's not obvious that this is a complete basis for the scalar fluctuations. One possibility is that normalizability on the entire sphere, precisely because you have this region of CTCs, is not the right sort of boundary condition to have. It's not the right set of modes. Perhaps you should apply some sort of boundary condition at the CTC horizon, for example. Anyway, so this is the problem that we have in even formulating the problem of scalar fluctuations, and it needs to be resolved before we can continue.
If you were to stick only to monopole harmonics, what would these field at the boundary?
I'm sorry?
If you were just to stick to no monopole harmonics,
mm-hmm.
what would these feel at the boundary?
What would they feel?
Well, like, you know,
well,
you need an anion, right?
So the monopole harmonics,
the vortex,
right? The monopole the problem is that the monopole harmonics don't see the vortex at all.
But they,
okay, okay, they so just, they're not anionic, right? So it looks like we're in the right ballpark here. We at least have modes of the scalar that are seeing the vortex, right? They have these phases. But as I said, they don't, you don't have an arbitrary frequency. You can't set up an arbitrary frequency fluctuation. If you, I think my battery's dying. Anyway, so that's where we are with, this is why I have no numerics for you. Okay. Do I have lots of time? Okay. Okay, so let me change gears a little bit. I just want to make some additional comments about fluids with vorticity, and I want to touch on this notion of Hall viscosity that I mentioned previously. So to motivate that a little bit, let's think of the analog, which is the Hall conductivity. Okay, this is a well-known quantity. If I think about, it's a well-known quantity that arises in systems with time reversal and parity breaking in 2 plus 1. And the point is that if I think about, so here we're just thinking about having some charges. If I consider the two-point function of the charge current, because there's an epsilon tensor in 2 plus 1, it turns out that there's an additional tensor structure that the two-point function can have, and the coefficient, I haven't been careful about numerical factors here, but the coefficient is the Hall conductivity. Okay, in quantum systems such as the quantum Hall effect, this is quantized, but even in a classical system, if I have a charge density in a magnetic field, there is an expression for this Hall conductivity. It's just rho over b. Okay? And you can establish that just by simple kinematic arguments, which I can review if you're interested, but they're very simple. And of course, this result has been found by many people in holographic systems, I think going back to Pavel's paper with Sean many years ago. Okay. This so-called classical result is the thing that is sort of the envelope for in the quantum Hall effect, where you have plateaus relative to. Okay, now if you couple the charge current to a background gauge potential, okay, this result is just equivalent to effective action, which is a term, Simon's term, for the gauge potential, and the coefficient is the Hall viscosity. Okay, so these two things are just equivalent to one another. Now, there's a similar notion for the stress energy tensor, or the stress current, as I've been presenting it here, again in 2 plus 1. Okay, if I take the two-point function of the stress energy tensor, then again using an epsilon tensor, you can write down one more tensor structure. And in this case, the coefficient I'm going to call zeta h, and that's the Hall viscosity rather than the Hall conductivity. And it can be non-zero in the presence of parity and time reversal symmetry breaking. Okay, so for example, it's an observable in 2 plus 1 topological insulators that have broken time reversal symmetry and parity breaking. Okay, the classic example of that is the integer quantum Hall effect. And this is a this calculation was done many years ago by Avron and collaborators, and more recently by myself and some friends in an even simpler example of a topological insulator, which is just the massive Dirac model in 2 plus 1.
So this is 2 plus 1 topological insulator. There's no observable like this for 3 plus 1, right?
Right. And it's just because I don't have anything that I can...
You don't have the tensor structure.
There's nothing I can... Yeah, there's nothing that I can write involving the epsilon tensor. So even if... Yeah. Okay. Now... What I just want to show you is, in fact, that there is a classical expression for the Hall viscosity, which is the analog of the rho over B result for the Hall conductivity. And you can get that in any system that has parity and time reversal symmetry breaking, such as when you have a magnetic field, okay, transverse to the plane. And I'm just going to discuss the simple case where we just have a uniform field. Or, in fact, you can get it when the vorticity, when you have a fluid with non-trivial vorticity. Okay. Now, if you remember, the Hall conductivity could be thought of in terms of an effective action for a gauge potential, which was a Chern-Simons action. In this case, because the stress current is related to the frame field or the metric, the corresponding action would be some sort of gravitational effective action. Okay, so you should ask what that is. Okay, now, before I get to that, we should realize that this gravity that we're talking about isn't dynamical, right? Just like the in condensed matter, the gauge field that I wrote down there was not dynamical. It was just there to generate correlation functions. It's really a source. Okay, and so in this case, it doesn't have to satisfy Einstein equations. It doesn't even have to satisfy the equivalent principle. Okay? And that's much like the boundary of holographic systems, right? We don't have dynamical gravity. We don't have dynamical GR on the boundary. Okay. Now, in fact, I'd like to point out that in materials, you can make states of materials that in fact have these rather odd properties. In particular, if I just imagine starting with a lattice that's imperfect, okay, what you find is that, at least in continuum language, you have sources for both curvature and torsion. And on the lattice, these are called disinclinations and dislocations. Here's a picture of a dislocation. Okay, so it's just maybe this is the simplest one to look at. It's just an imperfection in the lattice, and it has the important property that if I consider a commutator of translation, so if I just go two lattice units, two lattice units, two lattice units, two lattice units, in what should be a closed curve, what I find is that I come back to myself up to a translation. Okay, that's the notion of a dislocation. Okay. A disinclination is the same thing, but where you come back to where the frame comes back rotated. Okay, and in continuum language, this all fits very well with classical geometry. If I consider the commutator of covariant derivatives, the general form, if I take a general connection with torsion, well, there's a term which is proportional to a translation, and then there's a term there's a term giving a Lorentz rotation, okay? And the coefficients here are curvature and torsion. Okay, so you can imagine perhaps having some lattice system and then take some kind of exotic continuum limit where you end up with a dislocation density. Okay? And you would have to describe that in the continuum language by a frame and connection that has torsion, because it would have to have these properties. Okay, so they're exotic, but you could imagine sensible material systems that have torsion as well as curvature. But even in the absence of torsion, even if you don't want to consider such a state, there still could be observables that you get access to by linear response to torsion. Okay, and in fact, one way to think about this Hall viscosity is in precisely those terms, because the leading term in the effective action, again, just looks like a Chern-Simons term for the frame field. But if you insist on writing something that is locally Lorentz invariant, then this gets completed into E wedge, the torsion tensor. Okay. So again, I'm just thinking about this effective action in terms of, in the sense that E is a source for the stress energy tensor. Okay. And in fact, this is one way we did the calculation in the massive Dirac model. What you find is that if you allow for a torsional connection when you compute the Dirac determinant, there are parity odd terms of this form. Okay, and that's, as I said, that's one way to compute this.
The usual Chern-Simons action, we also use it to sort of stick fluxes onto charged particles, right? And sort of have some mean field description when we have many electrons in the many fields.
Don't ask me to do that in this case.
What's the use of this thing? I mean, does it have any meaning?
I didn't mean this to be a condensed matter talk, but yeah, we're playing around with such notions, but that's very difficult. But I'll tell you all about that later. Okay, so the point is that in fact this is the leading term in this. In this gravitational effective action, it's the leading term that's parity or time reversal odd. Okay. If you don't like all of that description, then anyway, this is the thing that reproduces the Hall viscosity term that I wrote before. Okay, so it turns out that just like the kinematical arguments that give rise to rho over b for the Hall conductivity, there's an analogous argument that you can give that produces an expression for the Hall viscosity, and instead of the charge density being in the numerator, it turns out that it's E plus P, and the denominator. Well, if you had a charged fluid in a magnetic field, there was a result like this where B appears in the denominator. I think this result was known. It's in a review by Chris Herzog in the case of a magnetic field. And the argument that I haven't given here, but the argument is that at least in the case where you have constant vorticity, you can follow your nose and end up with a similar formula. Okay, now, so I just wanted to review this because it's at least something interesting that you could try to establish. It should be easy to extract in a holographic analysis, but I should mention that this argument, in both cases, we were assuming a uniform field, okay, and the backgrounds that I've been talking about in the rest of the talk had non-zero vorticity, but it wasn't constant over the whole space. So this argument doesn't directly apply. Maybe it applies locally, but it doesn't necessarily apply in a simple way. Okay, so that's just a caveat. Okay, anyway, that's interesting physics, and it's the sort of thing that you should be able to see. Okay, so let me finish up. What I've hopefully indicated is that rotating fluids have some interesting properties, and it's worth exploring them holographically as well to try to make contact, perhaps, with some of these interesting experiments that are going to be done. And we're just, again, we're just in the process of setting up that problem. Okay, thanks.
Can I come back to these CTCs?
Okay.
I agree that in the boundary theory, there's nothing that's sick in an obvious way. Mm-hmm. But I guess I'm curious, what would be your suggestion? That you think these CTCs are actually okay despite seemingly they are not? Or what's your conclusion?
Well, I guess the point I'm suggesting, I don't have much evidence, right? But I'm suggesting that from the boundary theory's point of view, you don't have dynamical gravity, right? You just have this, you have this frame and you have the fluid, or at least you have the stress tensor of a apparently perfect fluid. But the gravity is non-dynamical. And so perhaps there's an interpretation just from the fluid dynamics. That it's just that you should think about it in an analog gravity type of way. That's very different from what you would say from the bulk point of view. Right. So the idea is that you have a sensible boundary system, and or you have a potentially sensible boundary system. Maybe you can, maybe these problems are just features of the fact that you have this vortex. And, So I think the thing that you're worried about is that it seems to imply that you have to. That this is dual to a bulk geometry that has bad behavior, and you have to deal with that in some way. Now, on the other hand, when I described a little bit about actually looking at least linearized fluctuations, you don't see much of that. In the radial motion just completely separates from what's happening on the boundary, and you don't. It's not obvious that. The radial motion sees any of that, and again, that's part of the interest in simulating this to see what goes wrong.
If you shoot geodesics around in the space time, are they happy to enter this region? Are they somehow deflected?
I think they enter. Yeah.
Okay. But wouldn't you worry? I mean, a probe that we're used to thinking about is sort of two-point function using geodesics. Wouldn't I worry that I'm going to end up in some kind of strange behavior?
Yeah, exactly. Well, exactly. So what is the strange behavior?
What's your project?
It's my project. I'm just trying to tell you that I'd like to do this project. Yeah.
So one thing that people worry when they rotate this stuff, right, Steve Chu and others, is the instabilities, right? Because you're rotating this thing is going to start flying apart because of centrifugal force. So, and I mean, where does this?
Oh, you're talking about a real.
Yeah, the real thing.
Yeah, okay.
The real thing. I mean, you told me that somehow you have canceled the centrifugal force by tuning the frequency. Or have you?
Did I? I didn't say that.
Well, I think really? in the Lagrangian when you were writing it down that you were messing around with the centrifugal part and canceling it with the harmonic part. But anyway, I mean, do you see anything like a critical omega where there could be an instability?
Are we in the same talk? I don't
remember. I'll show it to you. No, really. I mean, is there an instability?
Oh, God, I don't know.
I mean, there's another way of studying vortices, which is actually to study super radians. You put a scalar field in the bulk. And you
from Kerr, right?
From Kerr.
Yeah.
Okay. And then these instabilities appear there absolutely natural. There's a bound omega L bigger than one, and so on and so forth. The solution is regular in the bulk.
Yeah.
There's absolutely no problem.
Assuming you're in that case, but
Sorry.
Yeah.
Assuming you're in that case, you can have Boris is in charge and they're going to operate.
Yeah.
But he doesn't have care, he has the...
Yeah, I know. I'm just giving you a different way where this instability disappears and
so
the,
I don't
where
Vortices
is for me.
And coming back to this CDC front, so timing boundary is the same as timing the bulk.
Yeah.
So in the bulk, I have some excitation and hook up some excitation that goes around in circles in time. It's going to go around circularly in time in at the boundary. Isn't this something to worry about?
Yeah, all I can say is it's not geodesic, but you can, yeah.
I mean, I can drive my rocket and come back in time.
That's right.
And that's bad.
Yeah, time travel
is
bad.
Happening. He doesn't have that, what you're saying, on the boundary.
Well, I mean, time and the boundary is the same as time in the bulk. I have something going around in close time, like circles in the bulk. It's going to, it's image at the boundary is going to be going around in circles.
He's
going to
tell me again that I've been dreaming another talk. But as far as I understand, right, he has something totally regular, except maybe for these instabilities, but you're saying it's okay, and I'll buy that. So totally regular.
The background. I mean, if I put some fluctuation.
You mean in the bulk?
Yeah, in the bulk. I put something that's, so the and the boundary is not dynamical, that's fine. But then I can have some stuff made out of stuff in the bulk.
You know how I would interpret this? I would interpret the following way. I mean, okay, so maybe I'm dreaming this. I would interpret this in terms of this acoustic rewriting of his vortex dynamic. Because you see, his CTC in the bulk is going to go in some CTC in the acoustic metric or optical or whatever he writes down. But that's kind of an illusion, right? Because I don't have to write that metric. I mean, I just have basically vortices moving around in perfect fluid. I mean, I can write it if I want, and then we'll find the CTCs. But I think they're total illusion. I mean, I don't have to go and do this. If I were to set up an initial Cauchy problem in terms of these vortices, everything would be just fine. It would not come back.
That's the question, why, since the bulk theory is not global.
I'm not sure how you can set up a good Cauchy problem here.
But you see, because the boundary, okay, so the only weak link that I would find here in the logic, okay, is what does the acoustic geometry or optical geometry, which will introduce these CDCs on the boundary, have anything to do with the physics of the vortices in this perfect fluid? Because the physics of the vortices in the perfect fluid is just normal. Now you choose to go to this description, and it's some type of collective description, right? Because, you know, when they write the sound metric, they're looking at sound in a particular frame, blah, blah, blah. It's not the whole fluid, okay? So you're using a corner of your physics, you write it this way, in that corner you find the CDCs, then you pull them back in the ball. So I would say this is like an ultraviolet completion for the CDC physics. I mean, the fluid, the perfect fluid with these vortices would be UV completion. I'm dreaming up the top, okay? And you go to some corner of the physics, look at some collective excitations, you find your CDCs, but they're simply not there.
You thought of that.
If you look at perturbations on this fluid now, wouldn't they be following those time-like curves? Wouldn't they indicate the instability?
Yeah. Well, no, but that's because, you see, you're looking at only wrong degrees of freedom. You see, I say if you go in terms of these UV degrees of freedom, which is basically the fluid and the vortices, they don't exist. If you go to those degrees of freedom that make the acoustic metric, yes, they would. But it would just tell you these are the wrong degrees of freedom.
But then aren't you saying that, I mean, I could just forget about the bulk at all? I mean, I don't need the bulk. It's pathological. I mean, you're saying that the dynamics of the fluid at the boundary, I shouldn't recover it from the dynamics of the bulk.
I don't know how to say. I mean, you know, it's like defining the bulk in terms of the boundary, which would be the same. Let's say if you wanted to define string theory in ADS, we would say like, why do we define
then,
in terms of?
But then the dynamics
yeah.
of the bulk is something that I should also forget.
No.
Because the dynamics in the bulk is sick.
Well, for certain questions, you see, if you ask the questions about unitary propagation, Cauchy surface put something, propagate all the time, I think at some point you're just basically going to discover that you don't have the right degrees of freedom that make the Hilbert space. The Hilbert space is made in terms of this fluid, perfect fluid, and the vortices. And what you're seeing is when you go to this acoustic gravity, whatever, it's just a part of the Hilbert space. And there you find some signals. It would be nice to understand it, but that's how I understand it. That's at least the picture I have.
Actually, since you mentioned picture, you have this picture of the region where the city sees a city.
Yes.
And it seems that that picture, that region extends to the boundary. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So I can take a CTC in the bulk and within that region move it outwards towards the boundary. Doesn't that indicate that I also have CTCs in the boundary?
Yeah. Yeah.
But you're saying the CTCs in the boundary are not bad either?
They're not bad because they're in the acoustic geometry description, and that's not the total description.
Why are they in the acoustic geometry?
Well, there's only one metric on the boundary.
The metric at the boundary? Where the metric where the fluid lives,
okay,
is the limit of the metric in the bulk when
that's
I
right.
go to the boundary. And that metric has nothing to do with the analog metric. It's just the metric in the bulk.
No, the
no,
point
no,
was
no,
if
no,
I
no,
can
no,
interpret
no,
that
no,
metric
no, no, no.
of the boundary that I have in those terms. That's the suggestion.
Another question, right?